And now you're listening to the Saturday Afternoon Show. We are here live at the Wavefarm Studio, and we're going to get our mics figured out eventually so it sounds less cavernous here. How about that? That sounds a little bit better. I'm Tom Rowe, and you're listening live from Wavefarm, and I am here with Victoria Estock and Steve Lambert. Both of you, welcome to the studio here.
Thanks for having us, Tom.
Thanks. Yeah,
Steve, I know we're going to talk to you a little bit more in the second hour, but we should introduce both of you quickly to our listeners. Do you want to give a short synopsis of what Victoria, have worked both in environmental and experimental sound?
Yeah. I mean, I have an environmental education background, but over the past handful of years, I've been making sound interventions that deal with very specific situations and sound installations that touch on different environmental themes and in a really experimental way, I guess.
And Steve, you have a little crossover with Victoria, some similar backgrounds a little bit?
I studied sound a little bit. I also have like a music background, and I am agnostic when it comes to art material, so I used a little bit in the past.
And I guess you're known for a little more political work. I mean, people may know you from the newspaper. You single-handedly ended the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
There were a lot of us that worked on that, but I don't really think of like political artwork has such a bad name. I like to think of it like I don't separate myself being a citizen and being an artist.
I guess everything is political, too, if you figure it out eventually.
Yeah, if you're a grad student.
All right. Well, Victoria, you also have a background here at Wavefarm, too. You helped before this building we're in now was a building you helped work on all kinds of different projects here.
Yeah, it's nice to be back. It looks really different. Even walking around, I kind of didn't recognize the place.
It was this was 2006 and 2007, or
I think it was 2007, 2008.
Yeah. And tell folks what you worked on here.
I remember helping out with an installation that Douglas was working on. The Puff Bang Reverb.
Was, it's now a bedroom downstairs.
Yeah, and then there was a project with Lovid. They were planting.
All right, the radio calendula plant that bloomed in the spring, and they had a message that you could read both ways, upside down or right side up, like a old school calculator out in the field in front of us, too.
Yeah. And then there were the summer events, the Summer Winds, and the other event, I can't remember the name of it, that used to happen here.
Yeah, and the Puff Bang Reverb we talked about before was Douglas Repetto's piece that you blew on this block of wood, and it set in motion a string of other blocks of wood to...
lots of other blocks, yeah.
I'm underselling the amount of blocks of wood that were in that project. You helped take apart all those blocks of wood.
And string them up.
I think they were there in boxes somewhere.
Yeah.
I think it got reassembled somewhere else. I think actually all the blocks of wood got sent somewhere. And with the string still tangled, I'm sure. So you wanted to play? Do you want to play one of these tracks real quick? This is the sound work you were that you did a little bit after that time, I guess, after you finished working here.
Yeah. I think it was right afterwards for your La Superette.
And so this is called Wind to Overpass 2.
Yeah.
Do you want to set? Does it need a setup?
No. No, we'll doesn't need a setup.
Okay,
you can just play it.
We'll play it, and we'll be back in just a second on the Saturday Afternoon Show. We'll be right back. back on the Saturday afternoon show. I'm Tom Rowe, and we are here at Wave Farm with Victoria Estock and Steve Lambert, two sound artists. And Victoria, we just heard that track of yours.
Yeah, my Shiggy Otis remix.
Yeah. And you've brought a computer full of other sounds and music. And I guess tell us about the kind of sounds you work with.
Okay, well, a lot of my work is about creating these specific situations so that my listeners really start paying attention to where they're at. I don't know if that makes sense, but like I have an audio memorial piece I could play for you guys that I created for this 25th anniversary celebration in my hometown. And basically I was pulling home video recordings, answering machine recordings, and some oral history recordings and kind of put together this installation so that people, when they walk through the woods from different trees, they would hear the voices of people that had passed away over that 25-year span. And I constructed it in such a way so as if you were walking in between a conversation they were all having together.
So it's kind of like not just walking through a space, but walking through time.
Yeah, yeah, and I didn't necessarily I wound up, this was like a lot of research, and I wound up meeting with like surviving family members and friends, and really trying to piece together a audio memorial that was representative of this small community that I grew up in. It's kind of a gift to them, and it wound up being a pretty emotional piece for the town because I didn't post the names of who was involved, so they would just kind of walk through and hear these voices that they didn't expect to hear. And it's a close-knit community, so they wouldn't, you know, necessarily expect to be hearing their mother-in-law or, you know.
And how was it transmitted? Were there speakers through it?
Yeah, it's speakers in the woods around different trees. And the town is divided by kind of a green belt area, so you walk through the woods to get through the middle of town. And so people were just kind of walking there. And I put like a little bench area where they could sit. Yeah, so I could play that for you.
All right.
Okay. It's called Audio is the Realm of the Dead.
Hello. May I just remind you that this is the beginning of a weekend of celebration.
Talk. Everybody talk.
Every weekend there were dozens and dozens of cars coming to view the animals in the zoo, you almost felt. People from the city, people from Washington, people from colleges, people from foreign countries were coming here because they knew something was special and different about this place that we hardly understood.
They expected to see horns growing out of our heads.
There's a hold that this town has on us, and always has had.
Here we go again. Challenge at work. tradition that says that you must contribute something to your community to help make it the society that you want it to be.
When I was born, 1914, it was Hungary, and we lived on the outskirts of the city, a very big house. And we moved to, it used to be called Kolozsvár. It's even a song about it, Kolozsvár. Város Kolozsvár, ott laktam a szamosnál, hol minden piros, fehér, zöldbe jár. This is a Hungarian song, it tells you where I lived, near the lake, where everything was red, white, and green. It's the Hungarian colors.
They expected to see horns growing out of our heads.
We knew we weren't communists. We knew we were Americans. We've supported the American government. A lot of our young people went to war and never returned. So it wasn't anything of the kind. But there were...
I tell you, it was anti-Semitic, really. There was a bunch of Jews settling here in this Christian stronghold. And the people around here didn't like it.
I made lots of mistakes. And I realized that I had a lot more to offer that way than I had ever thought.
I'm Augusta Chasen. I lived here. I still live here, but I lived here from 1936. We were the first people that came here, and it's a beautiful town. It didn't look like it looks today.
It seems to me that the dark side of life, the somber, perhaps the menacing, the dangerous, the evil side of life, is something which I think the French tradition tends to almost totally ignore. And I just simply can't accept their vision of the world as being a true vision at all. I find that the interrelationship between the dark and the light side is something that is much more meaningful to me.
Hi, Daddy.
What?
Come on, it's not cold. Dad, I can't wait. It's not even cold.
You got too deep in the water. Too much water in there.
Shit. I'll be quiet. And last time I took it off, I forgot it here.
Sing. Oh, here comes that grill on. Sing.
How you doing, everybody? In case anybody doesn't recognize me, that's because I've been brainwashed, but I'm having a good time in the Navy. And I want to thank everybody for coming because I love everybody here. I love every one of you. And it's nice to come home and know that so many people care about my family. Mom, Don, I think you guys are a perfect match, and I wish you happens forever. And if you ever need me at any time, what you have to do is make a phone call and I'll be home by your side.
We're a town where people know each other rather well and tend to be rather supportive of neighbors, not just friends, but neighbors, just because someone lives on your street. It's a warm community. It's the kind of place with a diversity of opinion and interests and occupation, and it's very open to new ideas. There'll always be someone that you can share an idea, a thought, an interest with, and that's why I like living there very much.
It's probably hard to say. I think that a lot of it has to do with the poverty and the depression that I grew up in. A lot of it has to do with the fact that my father and mother were both radical thinkers, vegetarians, George Bernard Shaw fans, etc. A lot of it has to do with the fact that I was, even in high school, rebelling against a lot of things that I found very annoying or unjust. I think somewhere in the background there is a kind of an Old Testament feeling about what is justice, the prophetic idea of the necessity to establish some sort of a just world.
There's a very peculiar thing. It's like a zoo, you know, you feel a real emotional high. It's like taking a drink, except I don't like to drink.
There was no creativity involved at all. But I wanted to break away later, which I did, of course. I don't even think about it. I just do it. And it's a matter of the hand and the eye. The hand and the eye is very important.
For a second, you live another life. That's about what you feel. For that second that you're looking in, especially if you're looking into a Rolleiflex, which is a wonderful little square, and you see exactly what's going on.
I'm on the wrong side of this discussion. I think that anything that anybody does, no matter how tasteless, adds greatly to the... I cannot stand planned things. I think people ought to express themselves however badly.
I hope I remember now. I know. And every tool does a different job. Look at this. But I use a machine like this, the Charmin tools. It makes a big noise. And I very carefully do a 35 degree angle.
Yeah.
You keep lifting the brayer to get even consistency to the ink. Yeah, this piece of thick glass. There's a lot of intricate things going on. I made surprises. I wanted to add nature to it. I think we gotta keep our ecology going correctly.
Well, I used to do animals just out of sheer pleasure, but I also happened to be...
And their hand would live forever.
Right here, it's me.
And I think this is probably the first time in the history of advertising that the artist was asked what he wanted to do, and then they wrote the copy around the artwork.
Chicago days, and we find scraps of stuff on the road, in the apartment and things, and I would just paste it up and do it. And it's a woman with a pink stocking. I'm not going to say a word. It's just going to happen.
Is that this year?
Very nice river. I like rivers.
Huh?
It is, we could disappear.
Yeah.
This is some nice scenery. Some nice rock formation that you can sit on. We like things that are formated, such as rock formations. Here we are at the base. This is the monster that we will be tackling today. They call it Killer's Peak. It's pretty steep.
Ouch.
But now you're going to have to excuse us as we prepare for the Last Supper.
Yeah, look over here. Are those cows in there or hay bales? Sierra Nevada, because it feels right.
Some good.
Ashley.
I'm a star.
I started wondering what kind of an artist I was going to be here, and then I said to myself, what the hell, I really like to draw, I really like to figure, what am I doing, you know, trying to do things that are not characteristic of what I think.
I'm a real artist in the whole thing. Because remember I told you, I'm the artist, you're my laborer.
Well,
I feel that the artist performs the kind of function in society that makes it possible for people to use their intuitive faculties to be able to relate to nature and to life and to the human condition in terms of their deepest and most unconscious strivings and understandings.
It's a mirror image in its finality.
Your penance, their navy penance, each one is a different letter of the alphabet. Well, they come in several sizes. It all depends on what type of ship it's on. You know, usually the larger ones are for aircraft carriers or battle wagons, destroyers, destroyer escorts, and the small ships. I was at Sampson Naval Training Center, 43. I had 5 weeks of boots. If anybody's interested in joining Sampson, they can call me, 448-0064. Sampson Naval Training Center, boot camp up in Romulus, New York. Or a,
had everything. It had all the recyclables, plastic, aluminum cans, yellow container that you put it in. Yes, they threw water at it.
A compass from a destroyer.
25 years here. I was a weekend painter when I lived in New York. And when I moved out here, I never had any idea of painting, but they went out and bought supplies. So I had to start painting in self-defense.
This is my dummy. Down on the job. You'll have to excuse me while I strip him. That is a bell, a quarterdeck bell, from a battleship. On a quarterdeck.
It's like living in a ghetto.
Sure, in its isolation.
Right.
Well, I think that Roosevelt is saved. It's isolated, but it's saved by the fact that there are enough interesting people collected in one small area. Otherwise, it would be a total disaster, I think.
This is mine in 89. This one was in 83. This also I designed. This.
I was a great geneticist, and my professor was breeding cats to study the genetics of cat design. And he had all these cat skins on mounted boards.
The average speaker would get up and pound his chest. I am a culture, I am a Kulturmensch, he would say. I'm a man of culture. And then he would get on and speak.
Yeah.
What does he mean? He means that he can read and write and count up to 12.
That is superior.
And when I got there with those big bunch of cat skins, I heard the girls talking, but she's Jewish, so we can't have her. And I thought, what am I going to do? I'm Jewish. And it never came up before. And should I tell them? And then where do I go with the cat skins?
I think a man cannot become a cooperative just by telling him he's a cooperator. I think a certain amount of education is needed for that, to start off with.
And you can't start with middle-aged people. It's a little difficult to teach them. You start at least with young people, pretty much with all the same ideas and the same...
I think you have to start with children.
I feel guilty to this day, believe it or not, that I didn't tell them, you know, I didn't walk in and say, well, too bad, I'm Jewish. I just didn't have the nerve to do that. And, you know, that's every once in a while there's something you did in your life that you're ashamed of, for like when you were 2 years old or something. Well, that one keeps going through my head. This is the first time I didn't have the guts to say what I felt.
So that when Harry came to do the interview, and the first thing he said was,
turn your books to the wall, the bookcase to the wall, in case somebody else comes to interview.
Why?
Well, at that time, anything that was pro-labor, I guess, was suspect. Was that it was a very stupid thing to do. That, after all, they are city people, and it smacked of paternalism, and what was my father going to do there with a whole group of cloaks, operators, etc., etc. On the other hand, I had, if you want to hear my feelings, I thought it was good for my mother, and that was the only reason the children ever consented to it, because she worked like a horse, and she developed a heart condition, and with the heart condition, she worked in the store and worked at home. I want you to know that you could eat off the floors till the day she died. That's the kind of crazy woman she was.
How old were you at the time?
15, and objected to it strenuously, and hoped nothing would come.
Advertisement, the original advertisement, read, "We are looking for a homogeneous group of people who were acquainted with labor unions. They came in, they were divided between the workman cycle were socialists. There were other socialist groups who were Zionists. Then there was the IWO, International Workers' Order, which was a communist outfit.
Then there was very few of those.
And then, of course, there were the religious.
My husband read the Jewish paper, and they advertised, and we read the ad. I didn't read it because I can't read Yiddish. But my husband read it and said, this is a good idea. It was depression.
You want to hear what I remember?
Yeah.
I said to my mother, what did you do to me? You took me from Brooklyn and you brought me to a town with bars. Oh,
that's right. There were bars all along that street.
On Mercer Drive. I was so upset.
City people for farmers, farmers for city people. But I don't think he ever decided to come down to the city. He just did not like the city. He liked his potatoes.
Paros kolosva, ot lakamasamosna, holmin den piros fehir zöbe.
Then I met Edwin, and as far as I was concerned, he was a magician. There was all this stuff that I didn't know existed. I would say he was just a lovely, clever magician.
Oh, she was a wonderful human being.
I know you were one of the first settlers. Do you remember how you first heard about Roosevelt? How did
my
you...
Oh, my Max worked.
Ah, oh, where did he work?
He needed a job in...
And how did you feel when you first moved?
I felt a little lonely. I missed the New York.
Yeah.
The other people, if you look at their eyes, look at the expression of the people. They look afraid. They're coming into a new world. They don't know what to expect.
If I walk down the street, I'm a stranger here. I don't know hardly anybody.
I think this town, within another decade or two, the history will be largely lost. The houses, after all, look like conventional houses. And people come in here, they have two or three kids, they get a promotion on their job, and they bug out. And then these people are not really interested. I'd say 90% of the people in this town don't even know there's a council or how it's run. This will continue. This particular trend will continue until it just becomes another community out in the country. And somebody will say, how'd this thing get started? I don't know.
I think it's the feeling of having no power that makes you have no power. If you know you can do something about it, then you really can.
It's very much a product of your listening. And I've been listening to a lot of Iris DeMille. And we're going to do a song tonight called My Life by Iris DeMille.
My life don't count for nothing when I look at this world. I feel so small. My life.
let the body be silo and missile, the territory and the farmer sowing in Kansas, for the body is the last category. Let the secret pockets of the body be turned inside out, for out of the pockets of your body, fear, the small change of birdsong before a bolt of incinerating light. Let your skin shimmer laughter like a pool of quicksilver, for we are all at the end of trajectories.
All right, you're listening to the Saturday Afternoon Show on WGXC. I'm Tom Rowe, and I'm here live at Wave Farm in Greene County talking to sound artists Steve Lambert and Victoria Estock. We just heard a piece from Victoria, and let me read Victoria's background if you just joined us. She has a dual background in sound art and environmental work. Before pursuing sound, she was an environmental worker in both urban and backcountry settings. It was during this time that she became aware of a deep-seated need to uncover the intentions behind everyday actions. Her work highlights listening as a practice, often exposing emotional undercurrents, alternating between taking a playful look at what we consider to be reality and then sometimes a more poetic approach. Estock lingers on sounds and words, capturing listeners and having them re-examine what they are paying attention to. So, Victoria, what were we just paying attention to there?
You were paying attention to, basically, that's, you're hearing the roots of my community, which is a town, Roosevelt, New Jersey, where the past very much is part of the present still. And that was an audio memorial piece that consisted of 31 different voices, all of which are deceased residents of the town, many that I knew growing up, and getting a chance to speak again to the community.
What was it like for the community to walk through that piece and hear those voices?
I knew that it would be emotional for them, but I didn't realize, I guess, the how emotional it would be for them. To this day, I still have people approach me when I visit the town and talk about the piece. But I think it was just this sort of eerie kind of experience for them to be walking through the woods and then hear these voices coming from different directions. And as you could hear in the piece, like really recognizable voices. And I tried to select pieces of audio that were almost little sonic portraits of them to kind of capture who they were and kind of recreate a period in time. Well, 20 years.
You mean less about what they were saying, but more about the way they were saying it, or how they were saying?
How they were saying it, and just kind of the essence of who they are, and who lives in the community, and kind of a meditation on, like, this is our community. This is who we are. This is what's important to us, because, you know, it's full of a lot of people, kind of, you know, old commies, cantankerous kind of old folks, and also young families that have moved to the area to raise their kids. But I feel like it's a unique place because it's a community where people still talk to each other. There's no stores in the community. It's about 900 people. And it's, I feel like maybe, I don't know, I feel like I've been searching for that now in my adult life, and I've yet to find a place that really feels like a community.
Do they have a community center of some sort, like a meeting place?
In the beginning of the piece, I tried to pick some sound markers, and basically people meet at a post office, and they chat. There used to be a store, but it closed. No, there's a borough hall, and there's a synagogue that they open up every once in a while. But for the most part, it's just a small 2.5 square mile town, and people just walk and get together, and there's an arts project. And there's a bunch of little groups in town that people are trying to keep certain ideals of the town alive, because it was a cooperative project that started during FDR's New Deal that failed in some ways and succeeded in others. And then it turned into an artist community when Ben Shawn moved there, and a lot of other artists kind of took up in the town. And now it's kind of like slowly becoming very normalized, and trying to slow that down a little bit.
And what does the town have a sound or that you associate with it? I mean, I think I was talking to somebody recently about how the sound of like the town clock, you know, chiming on the hour was this shared community sound, and I guess train sounds before were this shared community sound. Are there sounds in this community that you can think of that are like that?
Sound markers for Roosevelt would probably be the bell on the post office door that opens. yep. And other sounds would be the crickets and the frogs in the summertime. But mostly it's the voices of people. That's the main life of
the town.
What makes
the place unique, yeah.
Yeah. So
that's what that piece is. And what is that called? Is there someplace on the online that people can look up more about that?
It's well, that's just documentation of the sound installation, but it's on my website.
You want to give that address if anyone's listening?
Sure. It's my name, victoriaestock.com.
Well, that's easy to remember. You can look on the WGXC website for the spelling there, and there's also a link there. What other projects did you want to play for us or talk to us about today?
Well, so what we just listened to was, it's a few years old, but it's been kind of circling around in my mind a lot because I've been working on this project that involves hyper-directional sound. And so lately I've been moving away from sound installation work and thinking about how sound could be an activist tool and used in an intervention sort of way. And
mostly when I hear about hyper-directional sound, I think of the opposite, is that it's being used as a weapon against activists now, hyper-directional sound.
Yeah.
How is it the other way?
Well, okay, so for people who might not be familiar with hyperdirectional sound, so this was a technology that was developed in the 1960s, I believe, basically to turn boats away at ports and also used by the military to control kind of populations. And then about maybe 8-9 years ago, it was released commercially.
Is this LRAD we're talking about, or is this...
No, I'm talking about hypersonic sound, and also Audio Spotlight was...
Audio Spotlight is the really hyper-directional.
Yeah. And there's like kind of two camps, one on the West Coast and one on the East Coast, that are releasing this technology commercially. And I've been using the West Coast version just because it's lighter and I can manipulate it and take it around to more places.
And the commercial application I think I've read about is like in stores you would go in and you would walk down an aisle and all of a sudden you would hear about some product.
Probably the craziest one that comes to mind is I saw an advertisement about a fair trade banana company using this in a supermarket. And so on the ground, there's a circle on the grocery store floor that says, "Listen to your conscience." And sure, it's great. Buy fair trade bananas, right?
And that's whispering in your ear there?
Yeah. And so you stand on that, and then it shows that what I saw was a video footage of it, and people are kind of playing with the technology, kind of stepping in and out, and they're totally surprised. But the creepy thing about that is within the first 3 weeks of using this technology, their sales went up 130%.
And the crazy thing to me is companies for years have been trying to control our exterior lives, but it's like almost they're trying to control your interior lives. It's like putting it like a voice in your head, literally.
Yeah, that is what it's like. So it's a real challenge to try to think about how you could use that for good.
So how have you turned that around then?
I'm trying to turn it around. So, I kind of see a lot of the work I'm doing with it as experiments, and the first sort of experiments were just trying to figure out what the range was and the kind of how people experience sound that they're not expecting to hear, you know, as they walk into this narrow beam of sound, what sort of sounds will really register to them and what won't. And it's a learning process all along the way, and how some people are really good at figuring out directionality of sound and other people are completely oblivious. I did some experiments with my neighbors around Halloween. I thought that that was like a safe time to experiment on your neighbors with like hornets and whispers and things like that. And then I was really gearing up for a project. I wanted to use it at COP 16, at the United Nations Climate Conference.
That was in South Africa? Or
The one that I went to was in Cancun. Yeah, and I had actually gone, I have a history with the climate talks where 10 years before that I was part of Greenpeace was like rallying up college students. I wasn't a college student, but I was in that age frame, kids to kind of, you know, urge the U.S. to sign on to the Kyoto Protocol, and because we're the generation that's inheriting the problem. And that was the first time they kind of started bringing kids to those climate talks. And I remember when I was preparing for that original trip back in 2000, that they had us read a lot of climate science literature talking about this 10-year window that we had. And at the end of this 10-year window, we were going to see the effects of climate change more readily, right? So at that time, right around, it was like 6 months before the climate talks happened in Cancun, I just by chance happened to run into the organizers of that original trip from Greenpeace. And I was thinking, okay, well, how could I combine my skills now as a sound artist, and I have this environmental background and passion, how could I do something that's effective? Because I even felt like when we were kids and we were going there, like we were chanting or we were part like doing direct actions, but they didn't really seem all that poignant, you know. And I thought, what could I do now? And so I started researching this hyperdirectional sound technology, and I thought I could go to these conferences and either haunt them by reflecting their own words back to them, or I could think about what kind of sound I could project. Like I didn't want to project anything that was just like totally rhetoric, like do this, don't do that. But how could I create and open this space that would like break into those climate talks? Because they're usually just so scripted. And I mean, people are exhausted and you kind of go into those talks knowing that nothing's really going to come out of them. And it was an experiment for me to see like if I could break through that with sound.
So did you try to fill the room with the sounds of animals that have been made extinct by global warming?
I thought about that. So that's the most challenging part. Like, what sort of sound would break through, right? So I did this preparation where I listened to 10 years worth of their meetings, which I don't recommend anyone do. That will drive you insane and get you really depressed. But I did pull certain clips that I thought kind of maybe they needed to be reminded of at that time. And which I could play a few for you right now, if that...
Sure, that sounds great to give us an idea of what we're talking about.
Okay, here we go. So I'll just kind of go through a few of them here. Should be working. Sorry about that.
You're tuned into the Saturday Afternoon Show on WGXC.
There's a Chinese proverb that says that a journey of 1,000 miles starts with the first step. I think this week we achieved the first step. Now we have to do the other 990 other miles.
The consequences of climate change, ocean warming, sea level rise, coastal erosion, changes in food production potentials are bigger than we expected a decade ago.
I, as a human being, I feel that the leaders who are you know, pushing their country to adopt these 2 degrees, they should know from science that will be killing a lot of people around the world. They should change their position. And for the second question about my position from this conference, I will not sign anything less than 1.5.
The protocol is result-oriented. It's flexible. It's fair. It's credible. It is the only game in town. It is the best we have. If we really negotiate focusing on the real issues. We can live up to the promise we made in The Hague, not to fail twice.
Because we are the most vulnerable victims of climate change, all of us.
As I have been repeating, it is important that the U.S. participates, and for all the countries to have the United States as a member, as a participant to the Kyoto Protocol, is the best scenario. It is important that all the countries participate, and also it is important that we do not spend too much time waiting for the United States to come in.
Without United States, the rest of the world can still issue the $200 billion to finance climate change. So why are you not doing that? Is it not to embarrass the United States? I don't think that's the spirit of leadership required at this moment.
We're back on the Saturday afternoon show. I'm Tom Rowe, and we're talking with sound artist Victoria Estock and Steve Lambert. And Victoria, that was footage from which climate change conference?
That was actually, I pulled from 10 years worth. So I went back to the one that I was at The Hague, and then just like following Bonn and other cities, just to sort of, that was my first line of thinking of if I could reflect their own words back to them, maybe that would open up space. But then once I was there, it was totally a different scene where, you know, the world changed a lot in 10 years from going to these climate conferences. And so there were lots of men with guns, and I often didn't have a lot of time, and I was trying to be undetected. So I'm wearing the speaker kind of fashioned like a purse, and I'm pumping sound through the speaker with my phone that has a soundboard on it, right? So it looks like I'm just playing with my phone, not really paying attention, and I'm trying to angle the speaker as I'm like walking in and out of the events that I could get access to, because usually you have to be a delegate or work with an NGO or be press to be able to get into any of these events. There are side events, or I was waiting for people outside of the events, like a sound paparazzi, you know, late at night, trying to figure out which sounds made the most sense.
Instead of taking their pictures, you were giving them sound?
Yeah, pretty much. I found, like, during the few days that I was there, that a lot of those recordings that I just played for you, they were a little too wordy for the time that I had with people. And so
You have to break things down into, like, a slogan or a catchphrase or something? Is that a...
Yeah, or meme, almost.
Yeah.
So I had a few shorter phrases I would play, but what I wound up playing mostly that I thought kind of broke through any sort of barrier, either logistic barrier or language barrier, was the sounds of children laughing and playing. And so I, you know, to set the scene, people would be coming out of these events at about like 11 o'clock at night, walking down a dark street, you know, to catch a bus to their crazy resort that they're staying at in like one of the most unsustainable cities, Cancun, right? And then they hear the sound of children laughing and playing almost echoing off their own body, like right off their own body as they're walking down the street. And either I'm like hiding, following them, or they're just not expecting that someone would be projecting sound. So even if they see me walking towards them, it's not going to register.
Did you get in trouble at all, or has anyone gotten in trouble for projecting sound?
I have not yet. I don't believe so. I know that there's actually a couple papers out that are talking about legislation for hyperdirectional sound, but that has not quite
happened yet.
Just
the free speech. There was someone arrested at the 2004 Republican presidential convention for making chalk drawings with a bicycle on the street. You know, chalk drawings that definitely like go away and when it rains. So just the limits on this kind of thing keep getting put more limits keep getting put on this type of thing. So what other kinds of ways are you looking at hyperdimensional or hyperdirectional sound? Excuse me.
Well,
hyperdimensional sound sounds even more exciting.
Yeah, that's the future. I think it's really important when you're working with this sort of technology to really be considerate of how someone might take this, because I have played around with this sort of technology in other situations where, and it was literally over the top, like I'm telling people to take off their clothes or deposit money and just kind of like playfully playing around with this. And I had a couple of people think that they were actually hearing voices. So I feel like there's a real responsibility when you're trying to figure out what kinds of sounds to or messages that you might be kind of transmitting with this. And I felt most comfortable with the sounds of children laughing and playing. You know, I did another sort of intervention with it on Black Friday and kind of at a shopping mall in New Jersey, and kind of was playing this recording of, in like almost a drowned out voice of, which is like, thank you, have a nice day. And I'm like bouncing it off different structures in the mall, and I'm noticing that children hear it more than adults do. And I don't know. I'm still trying to figure it out.
Do you think children are more aware of sound than adults are? Do we block out more and more things so we have fewer decisions to make and fewer things to consider?
Yeah, I think children are just more aware in general, right? And so I feel like that's why this tool has a... I see this hyperdirectional sound as a tool that could maybe break through some of that, because it's this unexpected hearing event that kind of jars you out of this fog that you might be in, where you're just like running this script in your head of all the things you have to do, you know, and then you're like, whoa, what was that? Why? That doesn't compute. Why is that happening right now?
And maybe that's some of why some of these climate issues are going on, is because people aren't quite as in touch with their surroundings as they perhaps once were in time.
Yeah, I mean, I could speculate on a lot of things, right? That lack of real community life, lack of really living in touch with the environment on a day-to-day basis plays into that. Capitalism, you know, just like working all the time and feeling like what you're doing is never enough. I think all of those things kind of play into your awareness of your surroundings.